Kia ora, welcome to episode 33 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Jacqueline Fahey at her home and studio in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland. Jacqueline was educated at the Canterbury College School of Art that would later become the Ilam School of Fine Arts at the University of Canterbury. She is now into her eighth decade of what remains a remarkable painting practice. She has work held in numerous public and private collections, including the Fletcher Collection, the Auckland Art Gallery Toi o Tāmaki, the Egantai Gallery in Te Tihi o Maru, the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa, the University of Auckland Art Collection, and the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna o Waifitu. Jacqueline is represented in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland by Gow Langsford Gallery. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil Jacqueline Fahey Instagram post for your reference. A couple of quick corrections before we get into the conversation. I refer to Jacqueline's cat as Elvis. Their name is Alvin. Sorry, Alvin. By the way, you might also hear Alvin in the background in the episode. And when discussing the painting Look Mum, They Killed Her, about the killing of the American-Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akli, I mistakenly refer to that event happening in Israel. It happened in the West Bank. In the episode, you'll hear Jacqueline speak about how her practice is born out of hard work rather than talent, although we might beg to differ, of being willing to risk not being acceptable in a societal sense to ensure that she could pursue making paintings she wanted to, hiding in plain view with her painting trolley to capture domestic moments in the family home, what she sees in Goya paintings that are still painfully relevant today, and the necessity for her to keep painting at the age of 95, but talks about what might be, heaven forbid, her last painting. We started by talking about her friendship with and valuable life lessons learnt from Rita Angus.
But Rita, I got to know earlier, and she was determined that I should go get out of New Zealand and have the opportunity to go to, of course it was England then, now it would have been New York, but at that time it was England.
And because Rita Angus, 20 years your senior,
yes,
she was providing some pretty valuable life guidance as well as painting
guidance. She was, and she didn't influence the way I painted, but she did instill in me the confidence, because they were women from the 30s and they had not been subjected to the boys coming back from the war, and what the boys, having had their fun, wanted from women in New Zealand. They wanted, as the joke of the day was, the chap building a house on a hill and saying, well, I've got the cage, now I get the bird and put it in the cage.
And Rita provided some valuable guidance around that as well as painting.
She did, she did. Mm. And very, very against me marrying and having children at this point, you know.
Mm. In your 20s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I was, 21, 22 then.
Yeah, very young.
And also, I was still doing this spy in the camp, I didn't realise, of getting to know, you know, very much into the landed gentry boys and the ones who'd come back from the war who strutted round being king of the roost and wild boys and treating women really with a degree of bloody-mindedness, you know.
Well, was it in those years, your early 20s,
yeah,
was that when you started realising that that women were really treated so differently to men.
Oh God, yes. I mean, it was spelled out.
Yeah.
Amongst those people. But then I discovered, it was right through male culture in New Zealand.
How long did it take from you realising that to bringing it into the painting practice?
Well, it was 56, 57 I painted Artist as Warrior.
Mm.
And that was an outspoken... And I remember the critic in Christchurch, I showed it in the group, and he said, "What can this woman possibly be on about? You know, what can she possibly mean?"
Well, it's a very forthright painting.
Yeah, but I mean, not read at all. I mean, he couldn't understand what was going on here. He just couldn't read it, that's all.
He didn't understand the meaning.
He didn't understand it at all.
I wanted to take a step back, actually, in the history of your paintings and talk about Ice Cream Boy.
Yes.
So a really early work, 1947.
Yes.
And, you know, to be honest, it's not immediately identifiable as a Jacqueline Fahey work. And when we were talking the other day, you said that it remains one of your favourites. So why does it remain a favourite?
I think because it had a lot of compassion and just looking in it, not thinking, but looking and seeing that boy's misery, you know, of obviously pressed into service to a poor family in Timaru. And Timaru was perfect for me to paint because my father kept local young men away, and we didn't know anybody. We all were either at boarding school or at university. So it was very isolated.
Yeah.
We were very isolated there.
Well, maybe you've just answered some of this, but I was wondering what of that painting, especially that you loved, informed future paintings of yours?
Trusting my eyes, I expect, but I always did. And that's something that whole idea of trusting your eyes and putting all words and intellectual life out of your head, because that was a natural process for me. I found it very interesting that Baldwin started talking about how...
James Baldwin?
Yes, that if you really wanted to be an artist, that you had to learn to do that. Well, I never had to learn to do that. That was what I automatically did when I was painting. And that painting is a perfect example of me doing that, not being taught stuff at art school, where I was doing medium sort of work, but doing it according to the teaching.
Because you would have been 17 when you painted that.
Yes, that's right.
Well, you've just hinted at this a little bit as well, but I've heard you talk about the importance of visual intelligence.
Yes.
And it sounds like that's not something you learned. You felt like you had that innately.
I felt it innate, and learning it, that's why I was surprised with Baldwin, that he would know that, especially with music. And of course, Baldwin said... when he went to Russia, all the Russians expected him to dance and play the piano or sing. And he said, "I've not got a musical bone in my body."
And are you surprised that he knew about visual intelligence because primarily James Baldwin, a writer?
Yes, well, apparently he felt writers needed it.
Well, that's evident in reading him. They're such beautifully visual books.
I know. I think he was a great writer.
How nice to come across another James Baldwin fan in these interviews.
Yes, I remember I told Bishop DeLaghi, I said, I gave him a copy of, what's it, Go Tell It on the Mountain, I think.
Mm.
And DeLaghi was totally confused by it. He said, well, a very strange young man.
Because structurally it's quite, yes. It's a little bit of a challenging book structurally, perhaps.
Yes, that's yeah. Right.
Well, we're going to jump around a bit here, but I wanted to actually ask about books a little bit, because you had said that at one point that books were just as important or more important in influencing and shaping the practice than maybe other people's paintings were. So why
no,
books?
No, I didn't. Did I say that?
Well, that's, the research suggests so, but
that's a bit silly of me, because that's not... I always felt a very real problem. I felt words in terms of my painting threatened them, you know.
Oh, that, the presence
that
of words.
I'm thinking in any literal terms for a painting was a threat to my actual using my eyes and being totally moving into another zone altogether.
Oh, so the books or words, in a way, were a threat to visual intelligence?
Yes. I mean, it was a bit like what Jesus actually said before the Nicene Creed. 3 centuries later, the Nicene Creed changed it all. Jesus never said he was God, and he said, paradise is here. It is all around you, if only you can see it. And I think that is wonderful, if you can see it.
So that has always been a bit of a guide for you in painting.
Yes, that has. And that's why I was always threatened by writing, not my writing if I did it totally separately, but letting it have any power over my painting at all. But then much later what I did was impose the words on the painting.
Mm.
So that they're two separate things.
When text started appearing.
And it was the cartoons of the French Revolution that did that for me.
Huh.
You know, with the tiny, tiny writing of a whole lot of stuff that they must have had amazing eyesight. You know,
yeah.
Tiny words and very rude and violent, and what they'd do to the king if they had half a chance.
I wanted to maybe go back to keeping Ice Cream Boy in mind.
Yeah.
But then thinking about the way the worked, and we've talked about Artist as a Warrior already, the difference between those two paintings. So Artist as a Warrior, it's almost, cubist, the perspective is really flat. Ice Cream Boy is, perfectly in perspective, really figurative. And then Woman in a Kitchen at the Sink.
And my Suburban Neurosis.
And all the Suburban Neurosis paintings.
Yes,
we're going to certainly talk about those. But that evolution of all of those works and those different visual approaches, all those different stylistic approaches, were you wanting to play around quite consciously with different approaches in your painting in those first 10, 20 years?
I was very influenced, not so much by Picasso and those people. I was very influenced by Rouet and the ones during the war, the grim, almost gothic French contemporary painters in Paris who painted in a very medieval sense to them, but very powerful. And those were the sort of paintings that I was influenced by, and the sort of abstracted shapes.
We talked about the Suburban Neuroses series, and maybe this is what you're referencing, but I had read with that series that lots of them ended up being destroyed. I think maybe after Barry Letch had turned them down for a show.
Oh, that's right, yes. That's, and Well, I just left them out in the rain and sort of...
Jacqueline, what were you thinking?
I was moving on.
And you weren't too bothered then to destroy work or to you know, leave work out in the rain. You were like, oh, well, bugger it.
Yes, that was it.
I can make more work.
Or just leaving them behind.
So is that where most of the suburban neurosis works went? They've just kind of disappeared into
right.
the ether.
Yes, that's right.
How lucky we are that woman at the sink has survived.
Just by pure chance, Bill Glass bought it. And that's why it lasted, why it survived.
I wanted to talk about some of the work that came in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Especially with it becoming so alive. That work became so alive with energy, both in the content. You know, there is so much going on in those domestic scenes. In fact, it almost feels like there's not enough room on the canvas for some of those paintings.
Oh, that's right.
But they're also really rich in making as well. There's so much colour and they're so painterly. So and for listener reference, a favourite is Georgie Pies for Lunch from 1977.
Yes, that's right.
Did you have a sense with those works that you were breaking new ground in New Zealand painting?
No, I didn't. I just painted. And I always think that... if you paint with any sense of the future, that it's going to fail. You know, that you don't do that. And you don't assume you're a genius or and you don't listen to the crap when people tell you that sort of stuff. It's persistence, hard work, as my mother said, 98% sweat and commitment, you know, keeping at it, and then a bit of talent helps.
So all you did was find a subject, home,
yes,
and a painting
develop
language.
It, and then see where it takes me. Don't tell the painting, let the painting tell you. And from that time on, I mean, from the very beginning I did that. Once you start something, and Leonardo da Vinci obviously did that when he would sit in front of a painting for a whole day and someone would say he wasn't working, he'd say, yes, I am. That's when the real work starts.
Just quietly reading
I'm
what's going on.
I'm listening to the painting. I'm watching and seeing where the next move should be.
Well, those paintings from the 1970s especially, they're so packed full of objects. So, you know, Georgie Pie packets, cast-off clothing, gin bottles, books,
booze. Well, that's a household, so that's for God's sake.
It's just what you saw.
Yes, and Nigel Brown was so good saying to me about that. He said, Jacqueline, while we were all busy taking everything out, you were busy putting everything in.
Well, did you find a joy in painting all of those objects?
Yes, well, I did. And often they could look so beautiful. I mean, drink bottles and bread and butter and the way children ate, everything. Flowers particularly, because Mr. Speedy would bring lots of flowers into the house all the time.
Mr. Speedy, here you live with that king's seat?
Yes.
Yeah. The gardener.
He came with us from Porirua.
Well, having so many of those objects, I know that you're saying it was just what you were seeing.
Yes.
But as energetic as they are in the paintings, they also project a kind of domestic claustrophobia. You know, there's so much going on. So was that an intention as well?
To me, they don't suggest claustrophobia.
They were just, what's there?
Yes, just what's there. And that would apply if I were doing landscape or anything. I would like to put everything in. Because I felt, particularly at that time, to not do that was telling lies, pretending, you know, saying, that can go. Why does that have to go? Why are we leaving this out?
I wanted to ask about your profession as a painter, including people as central subjects.
Yeah.
And your late husband Fraser's profession as a psychiatrist. They're both professions concerned with understanding people. So I wondered whether the two of you compared notes a lot and learnt from one another.
Yes, I think. But, well, I had, of course, been noted that the women I'd known at university were now locked into a domesticity and seemed to be losing their acumen, you know, losing their intellectual, their creative and intellectual urges.
And that must have been interesting to both of you.
Well, it was. I mean, I found that alarming, yeah, that they're having children caught up in society as such, climbing the ladder of success, the husband or whatever, and they're playing the part of the supportive wife and not selfish or greedy for herself. No, she is not like that, because she knows from looking at Hollywood films that those women are going to be badly punished anyway in the end, because that always happens in those films. And the good girl goes home to the small town, gives up her vulgar ambition, and marries the local boyfriend.
And were you and Fraser almost comparing notes about all of that?
Well, Fraser would come back confused and appalled at the alcoholism and desperation of the men living in these housing estates that had been set up all around Porirua and were mostly Fraser's patients, the women, usually bought by their husbands because they were having a breakdown. The woman was having a breakdown.
This is 1960s New Zealand.
No, no. That would have been before, in the 50s and in the 60s, that was going on, no doubt continued going on, no doubt is still happening.
So both of you, in a way, were conducting a study of the same thing.
Yes, and Fraser would come home and we would talk and argue over a drink or two drinks before dinner.
Good, solid academic argument.
Yes, that's right. Well, not strictly speaking. I mean, we were...
The lines blur.
We were human beings. Mm. And I would shriek at Fraser. You can't imagine, Fraser, that women are specifically inclined to madness. I'd go mad if I was living in those housing estates with no access to anything, him taking the car to work, me at home with the children all day.
So in a way, you ended up representing them in so many works.
Yes, that's right. And that I'd already been there with the suburban neurosis paintings anyway. And you know, that was really the guts of it.
Well, that brings us, like those works and that approach to work for you, yeah, brings us to how personal the paintings were. So, you know, viewers are often looking in on your family life.
And it's that's right.
And it's an incredibly generous thing to share with an audience.
But it also allowed me to see it.
To see your own family life differently.
Yeah, well, I mean, not differently so much as an insight into it.
To slow things down, to put it in a painting.
As I said, the painting tells you. So if, for instance, especially for in Fraser Sees Me, I See Myself, that is a perfect example of a happening from real life going immediately into a painting.
And as a listener aside here, I'll include an image of that work.
I mean, Those are my favourite paintings. Add too. I mean, the My Skirts in Your Fucking Room, that's a happening. Me standing there thinking, well, I've got the setup and the scene, but end and in bursts the children to do their thing, you see. So I just say, you stand there, you stand there.
Some of those paintings from domestic environment,
yes,
were presumably quite difficult moments that you were sharing. So, for example, Mother and Daughter Quarrelling from 1977.
Oh, yes, and I had to. That was an emotional... Mum was... who had so many... You know, she was a child prodigy, appeared in the London Gazette, holding her thing at five, having played a Mozart, something or other, and, you know, this is an extraordinary achievement and blah, blah, blah. And then she did matric, and he just had an incredible ability to learn.
Well, those moments that maybe were a little more difficult to share, so mother and daughter quarrelling.
I didn't find it. I did it for myself and to tell Mum something, because she had, having said to me after all that in herself and her own past and the jealousy that she suffered, you know, all that sort of thing, that she would turn round and tell me not to outstrip your sisters.
Almost regardless of what the reason for the quarrel was,
yes,
were you quite determined as a painter to share even those difficult moments in paintings?
I never thought of it like that.
You just thought, this is happening, I need to share it.
No, I didn't say share it. I show it.
Hmm.
I thought, I'm not the only one who's having these problems anyhow, so what the hell?
Does that also go to then why there's plenty of humour in the domestic environment as well? So I think a favourite painting of mine of yours is Friday Night and Fraser Has the Flu.
That's right.
Poor Fraser sitting in his dressing gown.
These punk kids.
Yeah.
You know.
Looking a bit lost.
Just waiting for them to go.
Yeah.
To get out of the house and go to wherever they're going.
So you were quite, you wanted to, you know, share or show those really funny moments too.
Yes, yes.
Which is where maybe My Skirt Is in Your Fucking Room comes from.
Yeah, but I wasn't trying to be funny.
Mm.
That happened.
Mm.
All those things actually happened like that. So it was real life.
And likewise, the chaos that seems to be...
And that was my visual thing, that I see this.
And likewise, the chaos that you seem to capture in Happy Christmas from 1986.
Yes, that's right. That was very much, and the way I was pointing out, though, that was a bit preachy. I was pointing out that Christmas isn't for the wife who's doing all the food, cleaning up. It's just like bloody hard work.
Well, how did you go about deciding? What was the decision-making process of what moments to include?
While I was painting, they would happen often. So I would start the painting first, like seeing some beautiful flowers and thinking, oh, I'd love to, that's beautiful in that light.
And then someone barges into the stage set.
Yes, that's right, the stage set. That's exactly right.
Screaming about skirts.
And actually, Tony Fonson did the same thing too. But he set, you know, made it a stage.
So really, the decision-making process was made for you by whatever happened in the house.
Exactly.
Mm.
There was nothing self-conscious about it.
And therefore, that's, like, one of the beautiful things about your practice is that it's so relatable. So is that why you also wanted to make those moments really relatable to the viewer?
No, I wasn't thinking like that.
You were just painting.
I was just doing what was there. being visually accurate. It wasn't a matter of using that part of my brain at all.
So the same applies when you are bringing world events into the home. So more recently, 2022, a work called Look, Mum, They Killed Her.
Yeah.
That's a, you know, a huge world event about the killing of a Palestinian-American journalist in Israel.
From within the context of me being locked now into this room for a lot of the time.
And I should say we're sitting in your lounge in your home.
Yes, I'm over there with a painting, you know, and Emma Ray and the garden is out here and Alvin is killing a wetter on the... You know, what's that window there?
Respectfully, here, Emma Ray, your daughter, Elvis the cat.
That's right. And that Augusta, Emma Ray did come in with this piece of information of, look, Mum, they killed her.
So it's really a by chance as much as anything.
Exactly. I thought, yes, that's what I do want to do. I want to talk about that.
All of those paintings that we've just talked about, I feel like a feature of all of them is that you paint them with a great degree of humility, like this humility in all of those paintings.
Yes.
But they also
I mustn't impose anything on them.
Yeah, exactly. But they also seem balanced with a real sense of determination and in some cases social justice as well. So it feels like with the word...
No, but the social justice is inadvertent. If I'm reflecting reality, then if something is wrong or ugly, it will show, won't it?
You want to reflect that?
Well, no, I don't want anything. I'm doing what's there.
You are but the medium.
I am but the medium. That and my eyes will reveal, and the painting will tell me. I won't tell the painting.
But I suppose you have to have a degree of consciousness of what's going on around you combined with that visual intelligence to come up with a subject.
Yes, but that would not consciously in any way... When I'm looking, I think it might make me look more profoundly, look deeper, but I don't think intellectual life influences my painting in that it's separate, and therefore I imposed words when I was being political.
So there's actually determination to remain really open as
That's
well.
That's right. So leave it to what I see. So that my political paintings, for instance, like the protest out here of workers, you know, going past our house and, you know, marching against Labour government changing into the middle class party instead of the Labour Party, and they were going past, and Emma Ray was looking out at them.
Well, touching on some of those themes, I guess, is you being labelled a leading feminist artist, and while I think that is certainly true, has it been a frustratingly one-dimensional
yes,
label?
Yes, exactly. And also, that gave a lot of women in the art scene a way of, as they like to bracket people, to put me totally in the 70s.
Yeah.
And then after that, seemingly, I died off.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's not the case. I mean, there are all these facets of Jacqueline Fahey beyond just being a great feminist painter.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, on the other hand, I did feel I could separate my visual intelligence and looking from my writing. And then write the autobiographies, and then my one about Elam and the one about the original Irish uprisings in New Zealand.
You were quite conscious in working then to make sure that you retained a dynamic of who you were rather than just being stuck with one label, a feminist painter.
Oh, yes. No, I never even thought of that, though. I simply did it. And I was prepared to run the risk of that, not being acceptable and not working. I did it for myself. But I'll make an effort now to get those two really finished novels published. But I've also got all my diaries, and I think the last three diaries I wouldn't mind getting published because they're so good. I mean, I was impressed. I feel that this year, what I've been writing about everything is important.
Well, that probably, especially keeping a diary and the paintings being a diary, I suppose, in a way of your life.
That's right. And A Spy in the Camp. And I was very much a spy in the camp in Christchurch onto the bigotry that was pervaded Christchurch society.
And painting, in a way, helped you realise that? Like you said before that the act of painting made you reflect on a lot of that for yourself.
Yes, exactly.
And to call on a title of one of your paintings, Can Painting Change Anything?
Oh, yes. I like that painting very much.
Well, how has painting changed you?
Well, it hasn't changed me. It's my way of being.
Well, has it made you? Has it helped inform who
you
are?
I don't think it's changed me. I've become more myself, yes, and more confident now. I mean, despite everything, I wasn't confident until about 10 years ago when I suddenly began to get a grip of, oh, look, fuck with that. I can't be bothered talking to you, lady, or him, or whoever. I can't be bothered going over all that stuff again and again and again. And I don't want to do it anymore. Now, bugger off. If you don't like what I say or paint, don't bother about me. Do your own thing, lady.
It took you 85 years to find that confidence?
Oh, no, not 85. I've known it all the time. But to say it, to just live that more nun-like existence of having a vocation and being committed to it, which is what Rita very much had. I mean, she was very much had a vocation.
What was your vocation in the painting? Was your vocation in a way managing a subconscious understanding of yourself through the work?
Well, managing my life so I could paint as a woman, that was the major thing. Organising my life so that I was able to be, to paint, you know.
I wondered whether sometimes you would look back on a painting and realise elements about yourself that you maybe hadn't at the time you were making it.
I didn't really look at them like that, I don't think. I think what I was thinking all the time was to just report, to see and then record it.
And is that as you were? Because I've read that you, like, wheeled your painting trolley around the house.
Yes.
So that's true. You would
wheel... Oh, yes. I had a big trolley and I would push it around and then when I saw something I thought, you know, caught, had something going for it. It would be often, if you don't catch it when you see it, you can go back to the same thing and it's not there anymore.
So your mobile painting trolley Yeah. That's what helped that immediacy that's in so much of the paintings. It did.
And so, I would often have to go to another room or a bedroom or something, and then a daughter would come in, like Alex, having been to a party, and just flop exhausted down to on a bed.
And create a painting for you.
And create a painting for me.
Does that mean that you as a painter were hiding in plain view with that trolley? The family was so used to it.
That's right. That's plain. That's quite good, hiding in plain view. Yes, and with Fraser too. I mean, if it had been other people there, I would have been painting them. It was what I saw.
So the family were quite... It's not that they were even willing subjects. That you disappeared from view as a painter.
Yes. Yes, they... Now and then I would, like with my skirts in your fucking room, make them repeat something right in front of me. Like I made Fraser hold up my father's magnifying glass to analyse me.
Yes, that's in...
That was such punishment when I said to him, you know, I'm your wife, I'm not your patient, Fraser.
And that's, of course, in Fraser Sees Me, I See Myself.
Yes.
And I'll include an image of that in the Jacqueline Fahey Good Oil Instagram post for you listeners. So we talked about books before and their relationship with painting.
Yeah.
They so often appeared as subjects, especially in work in the 1970s. So,
yes, that's right.
Like, I have seen Buller's Birds of New Zealand in My Dress in Your Fucking Room.
Yes.
Graham Greene biography in National Geographic and Fraser Sees Me, I See Myself.
Yes.
And then, interestingly, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in Georgie Pie for Lunch.
That's right.
So why include those books? Are they you know... Do they have specific meaning in the paintings, or were they just...
Oh, yes, all of them.
So what were the meanings you wanted to signal with those books?
Well, let's just take One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah,
that's obvious.
In Georgie Pie for Lunch.
I'm saying we're in a mental hospital, and that, therefore, this is an appropriate novel to have on the table.
Well, and interestingly, if I recall that painting correctly, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is right in front of us as the viewer, and then Fraser is outside with a fag and the hose watering the garden.
He is also thinking, though, that they should be outside doing things.
What do you think are universal themes in a painting practice that other painters should lean into? You've got a huge amount of experience to draw on. So are there universal themes in a painting practice that other painters should lean into?
Well, trust your eyes. And don't forget, painting came before words. Words were a shorthand from painting, a cruder way of doing things. At least the Arabs kept a beautiful script.
And trust your own eyes,
your own
visual intelligence.
What you see, and don't struggle, don't deny it. Don't try to be clever. You know, all those sort of cleverness things, those tricks to avoid actually painting, that may be interesting in its own right, but it doesn't compete with painting or replace it, which often people doing that think it does. It doesn't.
Mm.
Painting is, again, another thing altogether, which is strictly visual.
And
it's intelligent in a different way altogether.
And is that why painting is so important?
Painting is a narrative which was accepted and understood for a long time. But now, I mean, there was a period there with abstract painting where the narrative was despised. This is ludicrous.
Which is why you've stuck determinedly to a figurative practice for such a long time, or your entire painting career?
Yes, absolutely.
Because you want to make that narrative
clear.
Yes,
I mean, I loved the way in Renaissance painting they took Greek myths and slipped them in to the way that the Catholic Church was promoting itself, you know. But in fact, they were telling quite a few stories at once.
A lesson for you to be able to slip things into paintings like books as well.
Yes, exactly. It's you may do that.
I think last couple of questions.
Yeah.
At 85, you had said you didn't want to live past 90. And I have some bad news for you. You're now 95.
Yes, yes.
How have the last 5 years been?
I've been fighting, as everybody aged does, inertia, and being driven to do something despite the inertia.
Because you're still painting.
Yes, means you do, though, have to adapt a different way of painting. Mm. That is an adaption because you're not capable. I mean, I'm doing a big painting that speaks and is very visual, but it also has to be, well, a bit like I did the Williamson Ave paintings where I imposed what was on television when Bush invaded Iraq and put it on our street because I couldn't take what I'd seen visually on television out of my eyes when I looked at parts of our own street.
Oh, so again, it's almost that piece of painting the home again. You're projecting that outside world.
Yes, that's right.
Occurrence onto your own streets.
Yes. So I was pressing a dreadful happening where the Israelis at that time, and this was 203, that they were shooting at a father at the Rafah crossing, and there was a superb photographs in three panels in the Herald. They wouldn't have it now, but they did then. And it was a brilliant photograph of the father trying to protect the child by throwing his body in front of the boys.
I remember those images, they were
awful. Yes, they were brilliant. The photographer got, and the way they were done in three panels was just wonderful.
Brilliant photojournalism.
Oh, brilliant. Mm. I wasn't trying to improve on that, but it resonated visually so hard on me.
So there remains a determination to keep painting then?
Yes, that's right. That it's a necessity. Then I think this is my last painting, but it's turning out to be going on and on and on, adding things, taking away. It's a big painting and there's plenty of room to add. And
is it lifeblood in a way, that painting?
Yes. Like when I finish, I'm finished.
I hope you don't mean that too literally.
No, I hope not. But I mean, to say you're not afraid of death is ridiculous. I mean, everybody is built into you to fear not existing.
You have that fear.
Of course. Mm. I mean, to be blotted out, to not comprehend anymore.
So, last question, removing any limit of budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work would you love to live with?
Well, curiously enough, it's Goya, of course, and it's a painting he did originally on plaster now on canvas, it was transferred onto canvas. It's called The Fates. Amazing painting.
Why do you love it so much?
Well, it's of three women, and they are hovering in the air, holding up a bound figure of a man. This painting provokes me. I see it as a clear projection of male violence towards women and children transferred to older women. The witches of the old religion. Women as the eaters of sin. A very Catholic idea. It makes me think about what it so dramatically tells us.
In the absence of words from that time.
That's right. The way men won't accept blame. They can, for instance, like Trump in Gaza, dream up the most ludicrous explanations for what happened in Gaza. Unbelievable, impossible, but they announce it with complete conviction.
And you see all of that in that Goya painting?
Yes. I don't think that's what Goya intended. I mean, I think he most likely was a male chauvinist of the day, like everybody else was. You know, when he showed that massacre painting of those soldiers being shot, massacred, they're all men. So, you know, women and children were dying on that peninsula as much as men were, if not a great deal more. I don't doubt 70% women and children there, but there we go. But the fates were very cruel, and I do entertain the idea sometimes that Goya was trying to explain that the fates were godlike and that they were punishing men for their sins. But then as fates were cruel, I doubt if they would have been doing anything like that. It's hard to... And time changes the meanings of a painting.
Yeah.
You know, whereas once it meant one thing, later it seems to be suggesting something very different to another culture altogether.
The viewer gets to decide as much as the painter.
That's right, exactly, exactly. The paint use is energetic and meaningful. The composition is beautifully balanced. You know, he was amazing how he could do that, Goya. Just beautiful. A painting like that keeps you grounded. That's why I would hang it up, to keep me grounded. Needs to be on view as a reminder of our destructive past and our even more destructive present.
I don't know about you, but I think I need to take a moment to let those words of Jacqueline sink in a little, all too accurate as they are. As always, thanks for listening. As you heard in the conversation, Jacqueline continues to paint. Keep an eye on Gow Langsford for your opportunity to see work exhibited by Jacqueline, or contact Gow Langsford for available work. Please join me for episode 34 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.